Okay. Exam Thursday?
Are you sure you
want to
do that?
Exam Tuesday? Pop exam? When do you want to do kind of a help session chance for you? You always can answer, we'll always try and answer your questions, but. Has anyone purposely taken your planner?
Like, have a corner.
So, help. When help?
Tuesday.
What time?
12 p.m. Wait, we won't be able to wait. What day is Tuesday? Can we do it at St. Ben's?
Tuesday is a day of
Don't you really want to do it at St. Ben's?
Yeah, can we do it at St. Ben's?
I promised to do one of them at St. Ben's. How about that?
Actually?
Not this one.
Not this one?
Where would we do it?
We don't want this special.
I don't know. The rooms in the library are too small for this group, I think. Sometimes I've used those.
Tuesday, what day is Tuesday? Day 5. So we don't have math course, we don't have physics lab, that's perfect.
And we don't have anything on day 6.
We have this class, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So what time?
After class, after 4.
Really? Oh, after 4.
Yeah,
after 4. I see.
4?
Class.
4:15.
Oh, wait, no, I have something at 5.
What?
I have to sell things.
This is what I said.
I signed up for it.
Can you sign up? Change your slot to earlier?
It can also be in the evening.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
We do have
7?
7?
7? Or 7:15?
7:15.
Oh, 7:15.
I mean, a bus issue.
Okay.
I don't know. So 7?
Yeah, we have to get No, 7:15.
Okay.
Is that 7 to the 15th hour?
Could be. Here, I presume, unless we, I'm probably not going to bother to check out the room, but we can find a room, I'm sure, if this one's occupied. Questions? So what is 20 again?
So it says point charge Q is located inside and distance R from the center of a spherical conducting shell that rays K. Mm-hmm. And it says show the problem to be solved by the image technique. I overheard Grit saying that you said that we did that in class.
No.
Or something similar to that in class.
Well, we did, so the problem that we did in class was this, right? We showed that if we have Q and Q prime that satisfy these conditions, then we're going to get zero potential on the surface of the sphere.
Right.
And that's going to work great, right? As long as we now consider Q prime to be the real charge and Q to be the image charge. So that'll give us the zero voltage on the surface of the sphere, which we need. And we've then got the voltage every place inside, which we can use to calculate the surface charge density. So I don't see any, so you could recopy your notes and do the proof that shows that these things produce zero voltage there, but I don't see any reason to do that.
So just A, C?
Yes, yeah. You could say, in class we showed that this produces zero voltage there.
Okay, and then using those results, are we assuming that it's a grounded sphere or assuming that it's an uncharged sphere?
So if it's not grounded, we could just add a constant to that potential and make it be any voltage we wanted to, right? And it wouldn't make any difference to the problem. More questions? Okay, so I know. I take it that everyone believes that, right? So I'm not sure that everyone believes this yet. It's really exactly the same thing, right? There's not a dime's worth of difference between those two statements. Yeah, yeah. 3 is close to infinity, right? There's even a book that's titled 1, 2, 3 Infinity. So I don't know, you got these numbers 1 through 4 that you can try out. But you really have to believe this in your heart of hearts.
No, you don't. You just get tattooed
on your body. Are people getting comfortable with that? Maybe. Yeah, so this is obvious. This is 191. I mean, this is, I agree, it's a little bit more complicated. But if I write any function of angle, for example, as a linear combination of cosines, because the cosines are orthogonal, if I dot both sides of this equation with cosine m theta, the only term that's going to survive this sum is when n is equal to m. And the dot product of cosine m with itself is actually pi, so we get this equation.
So,
say again?
No, that's what we did in our homework, right?
Well, we've been doing it for a week.
No, but you know what I mean? Like when we did all of those and we had to pick the pairs, when they were both even, they didn't survive. They were zero.
So you're talking about where I asked you to integrate using Mathematica to Legendre polynomials?
Yeah.
So they were all zero unless we had the same thing, right? A 1 and a 1 or a 2 and a 2, both of those produced a number. No, so orthogonal means that they dot to 0, where dot means integral now. Yeah, dot means integrate. Right? So dot means add up the coordinates, right? So if we have an infinite number of coordinates, then the dot becomes the sum, or becomes this integral. So this is just like that. Are you happy with that? You gotta believe that. Because that's what Fourier's trick is. If we have a bunch of orthogonal functions, we can dot them on both sides to reduce the sum to just a single term. And the right-hand side of the equation is an integral we hope to be able to do. We're used to having vectors that are unit vectors. These cosines aren't unit vectors. They don't integrate out to 1, but in fact, they integrate out to pi. The Legendre polynomials integrate out to 2 over 2n plus 1. But you know, it's not a big deal that they're not unit vectors. It just means that there's going to be an extra term there.
So why did you do the first part? Just to say you dotted both of them.
Well, so you really need, so this you all agreed with, right? And I wasn't so sure that you all agreed with that.
So I'm asking, what are you?
They're the same. They're exactly the same. So this is just a three-dimensional vector space, and this is just an infinite-dimensional vector space.
So if you were dotting the other components, the ax and the ay with k,
yeah, so
that would be 0 because they're not equal, and that one would be 1 because they are equal. Right?
Yeah, so out of this sum, if I wanted to find out what ay is, I would just dot with the unit vector that goes with y.
Cool.
So if I wanted to find out what B3 is, I would just dot with cosine 3m, cosine 3 theta. I don't know if people are happy or not. You got to believe that. You got to believe that. So the typical setup for us is that we know the voltage, not every place in space, but on some boundary. So typically, this is where R equals capital R, which might be a sphere or a cylinder, depending upon it. So we evaluate the voltage at that spot, and then we do this integral. And I'm talking cosines here, but they could just as well be Legendre polynomials. They also have an orthogonality. And that's how we get these expansion coefficients.
Is this online?
Not yet.
But it will be?
Yeah, I always put the transparencies online. Yeah. Yeah, this is new, right? Sometimes I reuse transparencies, but not usually. Yep. So it's usually new, right? It's a new class, new stuff. This is this is the 2013 version of it. Okay, so if we're clear on Fourier's trick, another thing we talked about were finite differences. And it is true that, roughly speaking, what solving Laplace's equation does is it means that if you average whatever you're talking about, voltage in this case, over a surrounding surface, you're going to get the value at the center. So that we could prove that if we wanted to for a sphere, that under all circumstances, the average of the voltage in a sphere surrounding a point gives you the voltage at that point. We don't have spheres. We're going to have this square lattice or maybe cubic lattice if we're talking three dimensions. But roughly speaking, the average of those four green points should give us the voltage at the red point. Now, if we've just made a random guess for what the voltage is at all of these dots, it's not going to be the case. So we can update the value of the voltage at one of these spots by taking the average and subtracting the current value. And it turns out that things work a little bit faster if we make this relaxation parameter not 1, but some number more than 1, and we update phi. So we're going to go through the entire lattice of points, updating it, and it still won't work. So do it again, do it again, do it again, until things finally work. And so the kind of starting point for this, if we go back to last semester, for just derivatives in one direction, you take a point ahead, you take a point behind, you subtract twice the current point and divide it by h squared. That's an estimate for the value of the second derivative. So if we do this in both x and y, we're going to get the x points and we're going to get the y points. We're going to basically end up with the sum of the green points, subtract 4 times the base point, and that's going to be what the Laplacian is. Okay, and we want the Laplacian to be 0. That is to say, we want, divide this through by 4, we want the average of the green to be the red.
Is that h squared?
Yeah, so h is the step size, the separation between the points. Okay, so I mean, obviously these questions aren't amenable to exams, but they're great for real life, right? If you want to figure out what the voltage is and it's not one of these exactly solvable problems and it's not one of these that is amenable to Legendre polynomials or Fourier series, then you can always break up the region of interest into a lattice and you can apply this computer method. So those were the boundary values. So we were trying to find the voltage inside of a box that was grounded on three sides and was 10 volts on the other side. And if you look carefully at how that works at the boundary, if this really was a boundary, if I want the voltage here, I'm never gonna change the values on the boundary. Because they're fixed to some known quantity. Okay, so we did computer solutions, we did image problems, So image is kind of a trick. And once again, it's not really good for exam problems because you kind of either see the trick or you don't see the trick. But we've done some special cases. If we have a plane that is at 0 volts and we have a charge that's outside of it, I can make a solution that has 0 volts on the surface by just inventing a minus charge that is equidistant. So then the voltage every place on this plane is going to be 0, just as required. So that means that the voltage any place out here is just the sum of the voltages due to these two guys.
Or gals,
yeah. So, I mean, occasionally we can make this trick work with more complicated situations, and here's kind of another one. If we had a square corner like this and we had a real charge that was in this area, then by making a charge minus Q over here, we would make the voltage be 0 on this surface, but we'd screw up this surface. But if I mirror both of those two, then I can make the voltage be 0 here. So this set of 3 image charges satisfies the boundary conditions. It makes the voltage 0 on these two edges, and I've got a real charge here. So there are a handful of situations like this where there's enough symmetry that you can make grounded angles like this give you the voltage. Well, so this is exact imaging. That is to say, this particle here wants to be exactly as far away from this plane as this one is. And this one here wants to be that same distance. Okay, so then we went over to spheres, and we showed that if we satisfied these conditions, then the voltage magically was going to be 0 on the surface of the sphere, kind of surprisingly so. If we don't want the voltage to be 0 on the sphere, if we want it to be 5 volts, we could add a charge at the center, and that wouldn't change the fact that the voltage is a constant on the surface of the sphere, but it would change the voltage to be whatever we wanted to. If we wanted to have a problem where we had an uncharged sphere, I could just make the charge at the center, might as well call it Q double prime, equal to minus Q prime, and then there would be no enclosed charge, and that would be the problem of a uncharged sphere being near a point charge Q. Okay. So then we switched over to cylindrical coordinates, and now we have line charges. And first of all, if we have a conducting cylinder and we want to make the voltage a constant, I can't make it 0, but I can make it a constant. What we showed is that if you had this sort of situation, which is exactly the same formula as it was for a sphere, that is to say that that this distance, which I am calling d prime, is equal to r squared divided by d, then I made the voltage on the surface of the cylinder be exactly equal to R over D.
Why did we make it 0?
Well, 0 is a nice number, but we couldn't make it 0, and we didn't make it 0. We made it be this constant. Well, I couldn't. I was unable to do it. I was able to make it not depend on angle theta, so I could make it to be a constant, which is all, in some sense, I really need, but I couldn't make it to be 0 with what I've got. It would also be true that the bisecting plane would be another, that would have voltage 0. And if you kind of put the pieces together, we can have two cylindrical conductors that are separated, centers are separated by some distance L, and whose line charges are separated by some distance capital D. We could make all that work out too. And then we got these nice inverse Cauches. So if I really wanted to, you know, have Mathematica draw the potential that you would get when you had two line charges like this, one positive, one negative, and I know what the value of L is that I want the wired centers to be separated by, I could calculate this quantity here, and that would give me this, and then I could take the cinch of that, and that would give me the separation that I need for the point charges for Mathematica. So they actually used to make twin lead cable like this for antenna lead-ins. It's, but pretty commonly occurring, you have wires next to ground planes, and that's basically the same situation. And there's a corresponding capacitance that's present. You might notice that the units of these capacitances are on the order of 10 picofarads per meter. So, I don't know, 10 picofarads is kind of the smallest capacitor that we use in electronics downstairs. I mean, there are smaller ones you can buy. So the upshot is that a piece of cable can have a capacitance that's comparable to a capacitor, particularly if you're not careful. Okay, so they're kind of just three cases where we can easily calculate the capacitance. This kind of twin lead cable, coaxial cable, and the traditional parallel plate capacitors. Otherwise, we're going to have to solve some sort of numerical problem, which is, of course, exactly what you did. Okay. Questions on those image problems? So we're still in review, right? We did a lot of kind of miscellaneous stuff. So at the end, we were working our way forward towards dipoles. And we've talked about dipoles before. So dipoles are cases where we have charge separation, and kind of in a mathematically clean case, we have a charge plus Q and a charge minus Q that's separated by a distance L. And what we're going to do is to let L go to zero, but let the charge go to infinity, so that the product of the charge times the separation is some constant. And that kind of matches how atoms work. Atoms are pretty small and they have charge separation, so the mathematical dipole is not a terrible approximation to a real dipole like water. So kind of the setup is here we've got the dipole that's located at the point R prime, and we're interested in the voltage at some other point R. O is the origin. What's the formula? So this is the formula for what the voltage is at any old location. And I don't know how we derive this is kind of invent the usual point charge, except don't put a Q in it. So what we want then is we want a Q that's at R prime plus L, and we want a negative Q that's at R prime. And this is just Taylor series expansion. So this is just Q times L dotted into the gradient with respect to the primed coordinates. And an important factoid that we're going to be using not uncommonly these days is that with this function, a gradient with respect to the prime coordinates is just minus the gradient with respect to the usual coordinates. And minus gradient of R for this function, you should be really used to, right? It's like the electric field. So we have a vector that's pointing away from R prime, and it's exactly that. Okay, we also could calculate the potential energy of our dipole in an external electric field. So obviously we get the minimum amount of energy when the dipole is aligned with the electric field, so they will typically twist around until that's the case. The largest amount of energy would be if they were anti-aligned. And earlier, the book, I hadn't bothered to write this down before, earlier the book had calculated what the electric field is, of course, by just taking the gradient of this function. And, I don't know, it might be good to kind of get a qualitative feeling about how this formula works. So let's say we wanted to calculate the electric field in, you know, right above, as it were, the dipole. So R minus R prime is the vector that points from the source to the observation point, so it's in the direction of P. So this P dot R prime is just going to give me P times the magnitude of R prime. So I'm going to have a vector then that's still pointing in that direction. I've got two of them upstairs and five of them downstairs, so net-net, I've got three of them. I've got three of them that are pointing up, and I've got one of them that are pointing down. So the upshot is the electric field up here is pointing up, and it has this magnitude. It's falling off like 1 over r cubed as opposed to 1 over r squared. Okay, so the electric field here is pointing up. If we look at the electric field to the side of the dipole, so now p dot r is 0, so the only term is going to be this one here. So the electric field is going to be pointing down at this red x. We look at the electric field here. Notice that now r minus r prime is pointing in the opposite direction of p, but we have it multiplied by itself. So, you know, minus 1 squared is 1. So this is going to give me exactly what I got up there. The electric field is going to be pointing up down here below. Okay, so the electric field kind of goes around like that. Questions? Going, going, gone. So we've mostly been thinking about charge as being the source of electric fields, right? So we had, or voltages for that matter, so we had the usual sort of formula that if we wanted the voltage at the location r, what we wanted to do was to add up the little bit of charge that's located at location r prime, and we wanted to divide that by the distance that the charge is from our location. And we had similar formulas if we had surface charge densities or line charge densities. It was all basically the same. So what happens if instead of having our source of our electric field being charge, what if the source of our electric field is a bunch of dipoles? So imagine, and it's a pretty common situation, that I have some material, a block of material, and all of the little dipoles in that block of material are pointing in, you know, say one particular direction. How can I calculate the electric field or the voltage from this particular configuration? So the starting point for this for charge was, of course, to talk about the charge per volume that was the charge density. So similarly, what's going to be useful, required, is to think about the dipole density. So take some volume of, maybe too blue. Well, that's what I. Do I have a lighter color? Oh, I have this. Okay, so now I won't cover up those arrows. So take some volume of space and talk about the net dipole moment. So add up all of the dipoles that are in this space and divide it by the volume. Okay, and that's what we're going to call capital P. And it's going to be a vector, of course, because if we add up all of these dipoles, they're going to point in some net direction. So this is called the polarization. It's an unhappy word because polarization means lots of things, and at least the first thing I think about is polarization is light, which has nothing to do with this polarization. Okay, so if I then, you know, try and do what I did here, so we know that the voltage for a dipole is this. All I need to do is to add up lots of those little dipoles, right? So in some region of space, the little bit of dipole at this location is going to be the polarization at that location times the little bit of volume. Right, that's what the little bit of dipole is. Right, so all I need to do is to add up all of those little dipoles. So the corresponding voltage should be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught add up over all of the polarized region the little bit of dipole, which is capital P dv prime, dot that into the vector that goes from that location to where we're trying to figure out what the voltage is, and divide that all by r minus r prime cubed. So before we figured out electric fields from charge, now we're figuring out what electric fields are from polarized material, from material that's made out of electric dipoles. You might worry that, you know, a week from now we'll be adding up the electric field from quadrupoles, but we'll quit at dipoles. Dipoles are common and large and are pretty important sources of electric fields. Well, you know, if we don't have to, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? So it would be really nice if I could make this problem the same as the previous problem, which we already know how to solve. So is there any way I can kind of make this thing work for me? And the trick comes from realizing what this quantity is. So that looks just like electric fields, right? So if you think about it, that has to be minus the gradient of 1 over r minus r prime. Say again?
That's not a vector.
I still didn't hear you.
That's not a vector on the bottom.
Yes. Yep. It's always a vector. Yep. Even when I don't write it, it's a vector. Now remember that derivatives with respect to the prime coordinates are just opposite those other ones. So this could also be written as the derivative with respect to the prime coordinates of 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime. Well, what exactly does that buy me? So what I've got inside that integral is the polarization at r prime, and then I've got the gradient with respect to the prime coordinates of 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime. Can we write that in some more simple way? And if I had the long list of identities that were from chapter 1, what we can show is that the divergence, if we have the divergence of a vector times a function, and actually it's not that hard to work this out. So remember, the divergence is going to be just taking the x derivative, y derivative, and z derivatives. So if the x derivative hits, and of course we're going to use the product rule here. So if the x derivative just hits the first term, what I'm going to get is the divergence of A, and the derivative didn't hit that term. Or I could have the derivative with respect to x hit the phi, in which case I'm going to get AX times phi x, right? So okay. So I don't know, just to be maybe a little bit clearer of it, part of this gradient is going to be taking the derivative with respect to x of the x component, and that's going to give me that term there times phi plus ax. And all we have to do is to do that for the x, y, and z components and add them up. And I hope you can see, if I add this up for x, y, and z, I'm going to get that. And if I add this up for x, y, and z, I'm going to get that. Okay, so what we have is something like this, right? That's what this quantity looks like. So I can write this then as the divergence of the polarization times 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime, I'm not going to have space, minus this term, right, minus the, I'll live with it, I guess. You have to live with it, I guess. So I have minus the divergence of P times 1 over the magnitude of R minus R prime. I can't live with that, so I'll rewrite it. So what we have then is the polarization times the gradient. These are all prime coordinates, of 1 over the magnitude of R minus R prime. That's equal to the divergence of P times 1 over the magnitude of R minus R prime minus P dotted into I shouldn't have bothered to rewrite it. So it's this term here, right, that is the minus sign. I really shouldn't have bothered to rewrite it. And then I have the divergence of P times 1 over the magnitude of R minus R prime. Unfortunately recorded for history. So let's kind of rewrite what we've got. So here's what we started with, right? Here's what the voltage is. So what we've got then is the voltage is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up over all the space, and what we had was P of R prime dotted into R minus R prime divided by magnitude of R minus R prime cubed dV prime. And what we said is that this quantity here was exactly the same as the primed gradient of, I'll still try and write it, R minus R prime. I'm tempted to just call it something else. And now with this game that we've played about rewriting this in terms of divergences, this is going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, integrate up, the divergence of P over 1 minus R minus 1 R minus R prime minus the divergence of, and these are all primed derivatives, the divergence of P divided by the magnitude of R minus R prime. All of that being integrated dV prime. Okay. And this guy here is all set up to use Gauss's theorem on, right? The volume integral of the divergence can be converted into a surface integral. So what we're going to have then is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the surface integral of P dotted into the normal of that surface divided by R minus R prime. And we're going to have left over this other term, plus 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up over the volume, minus the divergence of P divided by the magnitude of R minus R prime. And at this point, you should be super happy. Right? Because these are exactly of the form that is someplace but has disappeared. These are exactly of the form that we have for voltages. So that's P dot n hat. So just to, again, to be a little bit clearer about what this is, in the original problem, we had some material that was polarized. And what we've said is we can calculate the voltage by taking P dot n hat and integrating that up over all of the surface. And adding to that the divergence of P, actually minus the divergence of P throughout the volume. And maybe you'll be happy if I just declare that I'm going to call P dot n hat a surface charge density. If you think about what the units are, P was itself charge times length, dipole divided by volume. So it has the units of charge per length squared, so it makes a good definition of sigma B. And let me define minus the gradient, the divergence of P.
Wait, what's that on the
bottom? Oh, L squared. That's L squared. All I'm doing is checking the units. So minus the divergence of P, I'm going to call that rho B, and I'm going to call that bound charge density. And you can see that it's going to have the units of P, which are charge times length divided by length cubed. And then from the gradient, it's going to have a length in the denominator. So in fact, the divergence of P has the units of charge per volume. So if I rewrite all of that, just using these new names, what I found is that the voltage due to my dielectric is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Add up over the surface, this bound surface charge density divided by r minus r prime plus 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, this bound charge density. And that's exactly what we've been dealing with. So we can take a polarized object and it's equivalent to, right? So if we have this, I guess it was black, if we have this material that is made up out of lots of little dipoles, it has exactly the same effect as some amount of surface charge all over the surface of this material and some sort of charge density that's filling it. Okay, so polarized material acts just like charged material if we think about what the surface charges are. So let's think about probably the most standard example. If I have something like a cylindrical piece of polarized material, what sort of an electric field do we think it's going to make? Well, it should act like kind of a big dipole, so that it should make an electric field that's kind of going around like this. What should be the electric field inside the dipole? Well, it's a little bit hard to figure out. But you remember that to the side of dipoles, the electric field went down. So if we have constant polarization, then the bound charge density is going to be zero, because the derivative of a constant is zero. So this is equivalent then to something that has no charge density throughout the volume. P dot sigma is going to be positive on the top, and P dot the normal on the bottom is going to be negative. And P dot the normal on the sides is going to be zero. So this polarized piece of material is exactly the same as a disk of positive charge and a disk of negative charge separated by some distance. And it's going to produce exactly the same electric field that this guy would produce.
So that guy is a cylinder, and that guy is the same as two charged.
Yes. So the original problem was a polarized piece of material. Say a polarized cylinder. And it's equivalent to this set of charges. And this is, I'm not sure, we haven't literally found the electric field from disks like this, but I think you can see that you could, right? We could figure out what that is. So if you tell me what the polarization is, I can calculate these bound charge densities, and I can calculate the electric fields just as well as I could before. Okay. Well, binding electric fields by integration is kind of a mess, right? So if possible, we didn't want to do that. And one of the great ways out of it was Gauss's law. So what does this do to Gauss's law? So if we think about what Gauss's law said, it said that the divergence of the electric field was equal to the actual charge density divided by epsilon naught. And what we now know is this charge density can be thought of as, I'll now call this the free charge density. Those are the charges that we can see, plus this bound charge density, which is an equivalent charge distribution due to the polarization. So if I multiply everything through by epsilon naught, I'm going to get epsilon naught times the divergence of E is equal to the free charge density. Those are the charges that we've been talking about in the past, the ones that we can see, plus, which is going to look like a minus, the divergence of the polarization. This is a capital P. So if I put similar things on the negative thing on the other side of the equation and rearrange it, what I've got is the divergence of epsilon naught times E plus P is equal to the free charge density. So this quantity, epsilon naught E plus P, just pays attention to the charges that we see, in contrast to the electric field, which cares about both the charges that we can see and the charges that are made up out of polarized material. So this quantity, epsilon naught P, E plus P, is important enough that we're going to give it a name. We're going to call it D. So it's going to be epsilon naught E plus the polarization. So I think technically it's called the electric displacement, but no one calls it that. They all call it the D field. So I'll talk about the electric field, the E field, and the D field, and we should be off to the races. Okay. So I don't know, maybe it'll be useful to kind of think qualitatively a little bit more about what these things mean. So we've said that the equivalent surface charge density was equal to the polarization dotted with N, and the equivalent bound charge density was equal to minus the divergence of P. If we think about the uniform charges, uniformly polarized material, what we're going to have is dipole, 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 dipole. And you can kind of think about what's happening is that the plus charge and minus charge from one dipole after another are going to cancel. And so there's going to be no net charge, except at the top where things won't cancel. There won't be any guy to cancel that guy. So we end up then with positive charge at the top and negative charge at the bottom and no charge in between. If the polarization is increasing, right? So instead of these vectors all being the same size, if we've got, you know, 2q and minus 2q and then not as big, plus q and minus q, and then, I don't know how to get even less. Maybe I should have made these threes, and then I can go a little bit further. So you can see that if the polarization is changing in space, now I don't get that cancellation. Right? At this location, I'm going to have a net charge. Okay, so non-uniform P prevents the calculation and produces this so-called bound charge density. The edges where we don't get cancellation are automatically going to produce this surface equivalent charge.
What was it? The non-uniform P creates the...
So it's the non-uniform P that creates the so-called volume bound charge. And it's the fact that the arrows don't have anything to cancel them at the edges that leads to this surface charge density. Okay. So, what sort of dielectric materials are we going to have? So if we think about something like water that is a lot of little dipoles, you know, so water as it sits in, you know, in a glass of tea in this room, all of those dipoles are going to be pointing in different ways, and so there's going to be no net polarization. If I apply an electric field, then we know that the low energy state is where those dipoles align with the electric field. So you know, because of thermal agitation, they're not all going to be pointing like this. But certainly when we apply an electric field, we're going to get some non-zero polarization as a result. The bigger the electric field, the more these dipoles are going to be aligned with that electric field. So kind of what we suspect is that the polarization should be proportional to the applied electric field. Okay, it doesn't have to be this way. And for example, it's certainly not going to be that way if we polarize 100% of the material. We won't be able to polarize more than that. So eventually this polarization is going to have to saturate. It's going to reach some limit. So you might imagine that, you know, kind of more generally, if we were to plot the polarization versus the electric field, it starts at zero because there's no special direction. But as we increase the electric field, we increase the polarization. But eventually, we're going to get it 100% polarized. But approximately, near the origin, we're expecting that the polarization will be linearly proportional to the electric field. It turns out that there are more complications if we're thinking about solid materials. And then there are cases where the polarization doesn't have to be in the direction of the electric field, basically because things can line up along lattice lines. One direction can be weaker than another direction, as it were. We're not going to talk about those cases. Materials where the polarization is linearly proportional to the electric field, those are so-called linear materials, and that's pretty much the only thing we're going to be talking about. But in general, there's going to be a non-linearity if we get to large enough electric fields. So all that's left is to name the proportionality constant. So if we think about units, the polarization we've seen has the units of charge per length squared. And the electric field, of course, has the units of charge per length squared over epsilon naught. So if we multiply the electric field by epsilon naught, we've got something that has the same units as P. And so if we call the remaining factor chi, it's going to be unitless. So this quantity is called the electric susceptibility. And it's going to be characteristic of the material. OK, so the bad news, which I think isn't terrible news, that's not the way the book does it. The book is going to declare the chi times the epsilon naught to be chi. So their chi has units. But if you ever look up an electric susceptibility, I've never seen it with units. They've always taken out the epsilon naught. Why would you not want to do that? Yeah, so the book, we're not going to see very many of these chi's, so it's not going to be a big deal. But it's a slightly big deal. I'm going to do what everyone else does and have a dimensionless chi. The book is going to, what the book is calling chi is what I would call chi times epsilon naught. Okay, so let's figure out what the D field is. So the D field in general is epsilon naught times E plus the polarization. And for us, the polarization was in the direction of the electric field and had a had a magnitude that was chi times epsilon naught. So that means I can pull the electric field and the epsilon naught out of this equation. And I've got that. And everyone calls this constant the dielectric constant. Okay, so it's just one more than the susceptibility. And it's unitless. And generally speaking, for most materials, it's kind of in the range 2 to 3, and maybe 2 to 4. Water is a special case. Water has a dielectric constant of 80, or 90, depending upon the temperature. Okay, so for linear dielectric materials, there's a linear proportionality between the D field and the E field. And that proportionality constant is the dielectric constant times times epsilon naught.
And what do we say the D field is here?
So the D field is imaginary. So the electric field kind of is a real thing in the sense that the electric field is the source of forces. The D field is this mathematical concept. Take epsilon naught times the E field and add the polarization. It's pretty useful. I wouldn't introduce it. You have to, well, you'll see it being used in a second or so. So in the absence, in vacuum, of course, there can't be any polarization, so the D field is basically just the E field times epsilon naught. So the only place the D field is substantially different from the electric field is where there's polarization. Okay, so the start of this was we wanted to calculate the electric field in more complicated cases, say where we have a positive charge that's in water. What's the corresponding electric field? And what I can do is I can use my new version of Gauss's law, namely that the divergence of the D field is equal to the free charge. So if I take the volume integral of both sides, I get the volume integral of the divergence of D. That has to be the volume integral of the free charge, dV. And that has to be just the total enclosed free charge, Q. This thing we can convert to a surface integral. So this is going to be the integral of D dot N dA. So we now have a new version of Gauss's integral equation. If we look at the D flux, the surface integral of D for some surrounding area, we get the enclosed charge. Okay. So if I make a Gaussian surface that is nicely spherical, then by symmetry, the D field just has to point radially and has to be the same on the surface of that sphere. So under those circumstances, the D flux is going to be simple. It's just going to be D times the surface area of that Gaussian surface. Yes?
So when you said the D field is like that, so whenever it's in a sphere,
it'll
be like that?
So say again?
You said
well, always is a big word. But here we have spherical symmetry, right? So there's no special direction. The only way the D field could point would be that way. If I had, say, a positive and a negative charge, then the D field wouldn't be radial because...
It wouldn't be able to be
Okay, so this is going to equal the enclosed free charge, which is just this obvious charge Q. And so what we get then is the D field is just Q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught. Oops, no epsilon, sorry. 4 pi r squared. And remember that the D field is just epsilon naught times the dielectric constant times the electric field. So we now have what the electric field is in water. It's exactly what we would have written down before, 4 pi epsilon naught over r squared, except it's reduced by the factor of the dielectric constant.
What's
that k? So that's the dielectric constant. So the dielectric constant, you remember, is 1 plus the susceptibility. And in water, it's big. It's like 80 or 90. So water is a polar molecule. So for example, in alcohol, which is also a polar molecule, but not as polar as water is, K is also pretty big. I don't know, maybe 10 or something like that.
What is an polar?
Say again?
So
a polar molecule is something where we have charge separation like water, right? So we've got Mickey Mouse, right? We've got O with its negative charges and the H's that have slightly positive charges. Well, flip it upside down. Then we have oxygen and two ears. So a good example of a nonpolar material would be something that is symmetric. So methane, for example. It's perfectly symmetric. It doesn't have a dipole. Things that are not symmetric, things that are not symmetrical but still don't have an atom like oxygen that really wants to eat electrons are also fairly nonpolar. So, you know, gasoline, for example, which is a lot of carbons and hydrogens, six, seven carbon chains. It's not symmetrical. But none of these bonds are particularly polar, so it's fairly unsymmetrical. Air, of course, there's basically nothing in air. So it has a susceptibility that's like a part in 10,000 or something like that. So its dielectric constant is pretty closely one. Okay, and eventually we'll talk about kind of simple models of atoms that should convince you that solids should have, you know, reasonable susceptibilities, 1, 2, kind of like that. That approximately speaking, this susceptibility is the volume that is atom divided by the total volume. So in a solid, most of what's there is atom, so the susceptibility constant should be noticeable. Whereas in air, only a very small fraction of it is atom, and so the susceptibility is going to be small. So water has a big dielectric constant because it is cheek to jowl. So there's a large fraction of it that is atom, and those atoms have a pretty big dipole. Okay, questions? A little bit louder?
You just hit us with a lot of knowledge right there. Yeah, it is this counter requirement.
Yeah, so most any material, most any solid, which is cheek to jowl atoms, is going to have a noticeable value for chi. And so as a result, most any solid is going to have a dielectric constant that's, you know, 1, 2, 3. Anything like a gas, which has a very small fraction that is atom, is going to have a dielectric constant that's basically 1, a susceptibility constant that's basically 0. Water has a particularly large susceptibility because it is cheek to jowl. Right? It's actually more dense than the ice is, right? Because ice expands when it freezes. And it has a big dipole moment itself. So other polar materials, like alcohols, would have pretty big dielectric constants, but I can't think of anything. Well, actually, I can think of a few things that are more than water, but they're pretty special cases. So, I don't know, in 2 minutes, I actually have more time because that clock says I've got more time.
No, don't do that.
Well, I might as well tell you this story, which won't be on any exam, so you don't have to pay it any attention, but it's the usual story that I'm sure you were told in high school chemistry, right? So you know that salt is sodium chloride, right? Positive sodiums and negative chlorines that are bound together by electrostatic forces. Why does salt dissolve in water? Well, it dissolves in water because of the big dielectric constant. It's going to reduce the attractive force between those ions. So there's not so much stuff that's bringing them back together. On the other hand, salt doesn't dissolve in gasoline, right? It'll remain solid in gasoline because the dielectric constant of gasoline is not particularly big.
Salt doesn't dissolve in gasoline.
No, it doesn't. You can try it.
No.
Putting salt in people's gas tanks, I guess that's a doing thing. I guess it's sugar that you put in people's gas tanks,
Why?
Isn't it? Well, to get even with them. It destroys their engine. It's a standard bad thing to do. Standard bad boy thing. I never did it. My evil twin did it.
So cheek to jowl.
Cheek to jowl.
So like, what is, I'm trying to visualize
that. Close.
Is it like, what are you supposed to visualize? The cheek to jowl, the type of white cheek to jowl.
So, I mean, the picture is that people are crammed close enough that their faces are right next to each other.
Oh, it's not your cheek to your
jowl. It's not your cheek to your jowl. You can Google it. It's a well-known expression of people with lots of gray hair. More questions? Okay, so, yes?
So, what exactly would be an example of
something polarization? So typically water isn't going to be polarized because the dipoles are going to be randomly arranged. So, if you put it in a big electric field, it will get polarized. So let me talk about the equivalent thing with magnets, because it really works out the same. So there are magnetic dipoles just as there are electric dipoles. And most material isn't magnetic for two reasons, both because the material itself doesn't have a magnetic dipole moment and because it doesn't get aligned. But we talk about things that are permanent magnets. Those are things for which the dipoles will stay fixed even in the absence of a magnetic field. So there are similar materials called electrics that will remain polarized even in the absence of an electric field. But they're pretty, well, just like permanent magnets are a small fraction of all material, electrics are a relatively rare sort of material itself. Yeah, so just as permanent magnets, the magnetic dipoles remain in one direction even after you take away whatever magnetized them. Same thing with these electrics. They would remain, the electric dipoles would remain pointing in one direction even in the absence of the electric field that got them going in the first place. So I think some of you may have used these. So piezoelectrics are examples of electrics. And they can be polarized and depolarized, and then they become broken. They want to be polarized to work. More questions? Okay, we're good to go.